You're listening to the Sound Atlas.
Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Captain Dean, and on this episode, I'm with a gentleman very well known to the Bowling Green music scene. He is the guitarist and vocalist in Chest Rockwell and Peter the Freshman. He is the drummer for Dos Cobros and the former drummer for Technology vs. Horse. And he's also a bassist in a band called Bass Invaders, which consists of three bass players that invade the drummer while they are playing. Josh Hines, welcome to the Sound Atlas.
Hey, thanks, man.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing excellent.
Well, let's get started with the number one question that starts all of these. Are you from Bowling Green?
Yes.
And when were you born in said Bowling Green?
October 4th, 1981.
Nice.
Yeah.
An 80s baby.
Yep.
What got you into music?
I have a brother, older brother. He's about over 3 years older than me. And a cousin as well. And we got real into, like, hair metal and shit. Am I allowed to say cuss on here?
You can say whatever okay. the fuck you want.
Okay. When we were kids, we got real into, like, hair metal.
Yep.
And we'd, like, shoot videos, like, faking playing music and stuff. And then as we actually got old enough to play, I picked up a bass. My brother had picked up bass before me, so, of course, I wanted to do what he did.
Yep.
And I got into, like, the Chili Peppers, Primus, into bass player bands of, you know, late 80s, early 90s, and kind of that's where it started.
So you got started on bass?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
That's what a real true bass player starts on bass.
It is home bass, man. Home bass in every sense of the word.
But eventually, over time, obviously, you did end up playing guitar. I know you're a fantastic drummer. How did you end up making that leap?
A lot of that stuff was by necessity.
Mm-hmm.
We started a band. It was me and Stewie and Nick from Chest Rockwell in high school where I played guitar because Stewie was a bassist and we kind of wanted to play together. And we did a band. And you know how it is. Like, you play one, you can kind of play the other. So I got playing guitar then, but I didn't take it seriously until about 2003. Pimp Slap was kind of breaking up.
Okay.
And so it's, you know, I tried to write some stuff on bass, but it's kind of weird to start out with songwriting on bass. You're going to just get super Primus ripoff or something, or at least I felt like I was.
Yeah.
So I moved over to guitar and, you know, started writing lyrics and stuff like that. And then drums was kind of the same thing where you're just around it because of the bands. Like, you'll sit down occasionally and dick around on it. And TVH, well, I played in a punk band called Ninja Vitus.
Going back, like, did you start, like, playing in bands around middle school, high school?
Like, just on bass or anything in general?
In general.
Yeah. My first band was called, well, we played one show under the name The Porta Pot Gang.
Nice.
Yeah.
And what year was that?
That would have been 97.
Where'd you play?
I think. We played a house party.
Okay.
And then we changed the name to Pen 15 because of the old penis joke, you know? we were truly, like, what, I think 15 years old when we did this.
That's totally good.
The first Pen 15 show was my first show with Nick Rouse.
Okay.
So we've been playing together
for a while.
Pushing 23 years.
Yeah.
It's crazy. We've had one band or another together for over 20 years. But
So Pen 15 ended up becoming Pimp Slap?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Me and this guy named DR started that. And we were born on the same day. It's kind of crazy.
That's cool.
Yeah. Kind of just like this is meant to be. But so that turned into Pimp Slap. And we picked up some horns when we were still Pen 15. And we only kept that name like not even a year.
But I remember it very well. I guess you were pretty active.
Under the Pen 15 name?
Pimp Slap.
Pimp Slap. Yeah, we switched to that name, I think, in 98.
Okay.
We had a show opening for Goldfinger up at Western.
Oh, yeah.
And it was like, oh, you know, if we're going to have a name, we got to do it here because it'll be a big show for us. So I think that's when we switched. But we had horn players, and we kept that band around until about 2003. We played our last show.
Okay.
And
that evolved into...
It kind of just died.
Okay.
Well, we kicked DR out of the band in 98, and that's when we got Jeremy Pryor with us.
Oh,
and
wow.
And so he stayed with us until the
I
end.
I forgot about that.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're the first person, I think, to mention Jeremy's name on any of these podcasts.
Oh, well,
I think.
I'll tell you some Jeremy stories.
Yeah, because you all were very close and spent a lot of time together.
Yeah.
I know his parents very well. I've only met him a few times. He was really good friends with my now, through marriage, like my nephew, Zach Pearl.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I know Zach.
Yeah, so they were close, and so I saw him at their wedding and a few other things, but I didn't really know him. But when I did talk to him and I was around him, he was extremely nice. He seemed really full of just music. Like, that's all he wanted to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Jeremy and I had a weird relationship. Like, we were like brothers for a few years, but I think, I mean, we were young, you know, so you're right. Still trying to figure out what you're ultimately doing. And we kind of started to butt heads a lot. And that's kind of how Pimp Slap ended, was we were losing horn players because we were like in college. So guys were doing other things. They're having to come back in town and, you know, interest is waning.
Growing pains.
Exactly. Of, yeah. When that band ended, you know, we were a 4-piece. We had one trombone player, which is kind of weird then. But Jeremy wasn't really liking the ska thing we were still doing. Like, right. The last stuff we recorded, it's kind of, he was real into like Alkaline Trio and stuff. But okay. I was still playing like super busy bass type stuff because that's what we'd been doing. And it just, they kind of weren't fitting together
anymore.
You
were still busy and he was kind of getting more into the simplified,
right,
laid back kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say it clashed, but it was certainly it wasn't ideal, I guess. So when we stopped playing, it wasn't like hard feelings, but it was kind of like, you know what, we shouldn't play together anymore. Like, this isn't working. And then fast forward, like, not even a year, and we started Commander together.
Oh,
right. He moved to drums.
I knew you were going to be full of a lot of names. I couldn't retain them all. I tried at the beginning to list the ones as of today.
I mean, Commander broke up over 11 years ago, so it's, you got to be...
But, you know, it's weird, is 11 years ago isn't that long.
It doesn't feel like it.
It doesn't.
I still remember how to play some of that stuff.
It is, but when you look at... you know, as of today, you are in several projects, but you've been in some of those for quite a while.
Right. Yeah.
And so it's just, it's weird to me that 11 years isn't really that long at this age, I guess.
I mean, you know, we started getting ready to do Chest Rockwell again, maybe back in the summer, because we kind of took a little break with Peter the Frenchman.
Seth told me you guys were going to start rehearsing again.
Yeah. And we played some songs off our first album, and it was like, this song is 14 years old. Like, how fucked up is that? Came right back. Yeah.
So Pimp Slap evolved into Commander.
Sort of.
As far as you involve, you as a person kind of went from one to another.
Commander and Chest Rockwell both.
Kind of started around the same time?
Yeah. Nick was away in college for another semester when Pimp Slap broke up.
Okay.
So when he came back, I'd already written some songs, and we just kind of, and we picked Stewie up, and we kind of just started playing the stuff I had written, and that was the way we started.
Okay.
And about the time we actually got together, Commander started as well.
Okay.
And Commander, we were called Hacksaw for one show. We didn't have a vocalist, and we played the Soakie Fair just as an instrumental, like,
that's awesome,
like thrash metal band. It was bizarre. But then we got back together maybe like 6 months later, and we picked up Chris Hightower, the vocalist. I'd been in a previous metal band with him years before. And so, yeah, both of those, Chest and Commander, kind of both is what basically came out of Pimp Slap.
Okay.
To, I mean, going from a ska punk band to a thrash metal band and like this like prog rock band is like, well, how in the world did that happen? But
because you love music.
Yeah.
And you soak it up like a sponge. I think that that's the best part, you know.
Oh, I totally agree.
The ones
agree,
that
man.
Aren't tunnel vision about it. You know, I've met a lot of guys that they are stuck. They can do one thing really good, and they do it well, and they stick to it. I like, you know, I'm relatable to you on the level of being able to play several instruments, but also influenced by a lot of music.
Yeah.
Love playing a lot of different music. And that brings me to the wonderful question of who are your influences? Not only as music lover, fan, but as a musician, especially a musician of different instruments. Who do you pull a lot of inspiration from on all levels?
This will be interesting. Okay. So initially, I would say on bass, it was where I started with like Flea and Les Claypool and stuff like that. And I think pushing that stuff really early on got it to where, I mean, I don't want to sound like a dick, but like, I'm a pretty good bass player. Like, I feel good about playing bass.
I'll vouch you.
I mean, like, I would never, when you were like, oh, you're a good drummer, I would never say I'm a good drummer. But I feel
you're a good drummer as far as you're solid and in the pocket.
Well, I appreciate it.
You're not flashy and show off. Well,
definitely
and stupid
not.
And all that stuff. You play for the song and you play what needs to be played, and therefore you're a good drummer.
Well, I do.
Don't ever argue with me.
Okay, I appreciate that viewpoint. Yeah. It's knowing what not to play. Yeah, and it's not Phil's because I can't. But yeah, so so with bass, you know, it started out with that stuff because, I mean, everybody's going to say, oh, those are the bass masters when at that time.
But it also, like, maybe in your sound or your actual performance, your influences are known to come out.
Right.
And people can go, oh, that sounds like something Flea would do. But and you're like, well, yeah, it might, because that's a big influence on me.
Yeah.
But you don't sit down and go, I'm going to write stuff like Flea.
Right. You know? I got that a little bit in the early days, like, because Pimp Slap was, you know, ska band, so mm-hmm. the bass is usually pretty active in that stuff, but I tried to approach it a little different. I would, you know, slap some stuff or whatever.
Right.
You know, and around here, at that time, we were the only ska.
I think you were pimp slapping that shit.
That's, yeah. I like it. I like it. But as I got older...
Yeah, as you went to, like, starting to play guitar and drums.
Yeah.
I mean, did you just kind of do it yourself, like DIY, or did you go, hey, I'm a really big fan of this band and that drummer, I'm going to approach it like that?
I have done that on occasion.
Yeah.
I mean, you know how it is, like, when you're self-taught on something, you kind of just, it naturally goes wherever
right.
it goes.
You learn so much from influences.
Yeah.
You kind of watch and learn influences, but then you really do become your own.
Yeah.
As a player and writer, in a way, you don't necessarily hope. I mean, the people I've met don't kind of end up in that rut, so to speak, of being a cookie cutter.
Just like boxing yourself in.
It's like they get you started.
Yeah.
And then you kind of launch from there and
along
the way discover a plethora of different types of music and musicians and. Take little bits and pieces from it.
It's funny because, like, with guitar playing, when we first started Chest Rockwell, I was way more, like, I'm a big Radiohead fan.
Okay.
And so I did actually kind of aim for that a little bit with some of the different rhythms and getting this all the odd meter times and stuff. And so the sort of progressive aspect that that band took kind of originated from somewhere that maybe you don't hear anymore.
Right.
Because, I mean, I played a lot of acoustic in the early days and stuff like that. But I'm a big John Frusciante fan as well, like even outside of the Chili Peppers. So
I met him at a show, and it was on the Californication tour.
Man.
And to me, Frusciante, which I'm also a huge, obviously, Eddie Van Halen. As far as guitar players go, I idolize a lot of the same ones most other people do. But Frusciante, in my mind, in my personal opinion, he's... My Hendrix.
Yeah.
Like, he's the one.
It's a completely different approach.
Anybody can even attempt to approach as far as modern day.
Right.
Obviously, a lot have come and gone that are no longer around. And you can say, oh, they were just great guitar god people, but they're dead.
Yeah.
And we got to live on Earth and experience this man in this time.
Yeah.
And so it was 3 seconds of time, but I got to see the Peppers on that tour in Nashville, and I had backstage passes.
Oh, man.
And
so that was at
Starwood.
I was at that show.
With the Foo Fighters.
Yep.
And my brother had backstage passes, and we met Flea, got his autograph. I've met Chad a few times, so I got to see him again and get some stuff from him. He broke a stick while they were playing. I was sitting behind Flea's amps while they were playing.
Oh, shit.
And Chad broke a stick, and it literally landed on the floor, like, right in front of me. So I was like, hey, cool. I got a memento from tonight. But after the show, we're wandering around backstage, and lo and behold, John Frusciante walks right up in front of me, like, hollering across the way for somebody to get their attention. And I just immediately was, like, frozen. And I was like, hey, John, great show, or some stupid thing. And he was like, oh, cool, thanks, man.
Wow.
And it was, like, that fast.
That's awesome.
But I'm so proud of that moment.
You know,
because,
man,
of course, he left the band again. And
I'm pretty sure that time period is when he was dating Mila Jovovich, who was, like, my number one goddess.
I think so.
And
99?
Man,
or
yeah,
summer of 2000,
it was somewhere
actually.
In there. So yeah. You might have just barely missed her.
I'm pretty sure she was
there.
I'd
kiss the ground you walk on.
I know Flea's daughter was there. The best part of that memory, I'm sorry to interrupt your
personal
interview.
No, you're good, man.
But the best part, being a Chili Pepper fan, I guess you would appreciate this. We're sitting there on the side of the stage. The lights go out. It's their turn. And my brother and I turn and look, and here they come. And it was just the four of them being guided down the hall with one guy holding a flashlight.
Oh,
the
ground.
At
the shit you see in documentaries.
So it was like so surreal to see the four guys of that era, the Mother's Milk and all that stuff, that was like, my heart just like fluttered. I was like, oh my God. I was like, I never thought I'd see that.
Yeah.
Because I thought, I was one of those people that thought Frusciante was gone and
right.
you'd never see that again. So what a great thing. And I'm glad you were there because
yeah, was
a lot
show.
Of people are huge Chili Pepper fans yeah. that never got to see him.
I saw them a couple months before that in Lexington.
Yeah, I was there too.
And then I got to see them in, now, you know what was awesome about that? Muse was the opener.
Yes.
And
yes.
Muse is actually a,
that's a big thing for you.
Huge influence. Well, their first like maybe three and a half albums.
Right.
Huge influence on me. I mean, you know, going 10, 12 years ago. Mm-hmm. Not anymore, but that was the first time I'd even heard of them.
Oh, okay.
And so it was like, you look at that lineup now, it's like Muse, Foo yeah. Fighters, Chili Peppers. That's like that infamous lineup of, was it Nirvana, Pearl Jam, and the Chili Peppers from like 92 or something?
Yeah.
Where you're just like, man, there's like three rock god bands touring together.
Nirvana did do a leg of that tour.
I mean, you're not going to get a show like that again, but yeah. And then I got to see him in 2007 on the Stadium Arcadium tour down in Nashville.
One. I wish I could have seen that.
It was good.
It was really good.
And that's when they were layering so much that they had to pull like extra guys
right.
and who now is their guitarist Josh Klinghoffer
yeah,
was part
Josh
of that.
Josh was part of that tour yeah. which was kind of like hey he was like hey
yeah
I can sit at home again and make millions of dollars right. and let this guy go do it
yeah
but I'm with you on the Chili Pepper fandom. I'll absolutely
well, you,
love them.
Well hell they'll throw another band at you. I play bass in Bad Dudes.
Oh yeah,
the Chili Peppers See, tribute band.
I knew that
yeah.
coming into this, well, but I didn't write it down.
We just did one show lately. We got another one coming up, but we did it 4 years ago and then never did it again.
Oh, okay.
And Nick Rouse is in that with me and right. then a friend of mine, Tyler, and then J.D. Minor is the singer of that
okay.
one.
Okay. And now, so, speaking of J.D., he is in Dos Cobros.
Yes.
How did that come about?
It actually came about from the first Bad Dudes run okay. we did in 2014. JD and I have known each other for probably 20 years. I mean, we kind of met back in the Diggler's days, like right. the late 90s, and then doing shows together with Hungry Ears and Fountain Square Centers and all that over
See,
the years.
We're skipping a lot of names by accident.
Yeah, well, it's all good. Bringing them back.
Yep.
But so when we were doing Bad Dudes then, we kind of just, he and I would like go out to dinner maybe after a practice, and it was, we connected on this level where it was like, in Hungry Years, that was almost like to him what Chester Rockwell is to me.
Right.
It's the band that like he was there. You do all the booking. You do the majority of the songwriting. You do the interviews type things or handling the merchandise, sending stuff out. I mean, like it all kind of, you know how it is. It falls usually on one guy.
Right.
And so we kind of were able to share our frustrations and stories with that. And plus, Chester Rockwell and the Hungry Years both were never like super popular bands. So you'd see these big shows in town and, oh, who's left off of it? You know, these same six bands kind yeah. of over and over again that
yeah,
aren't really
that
in that clique.
Yeah, seem to be like part of the roller coaster.
Yeah. yeah. And so we had frustrations with that. So we just kind of had this bond. And then about 2 years later, I guess, the Hungry Years did sort of, I think it was supposed to be their final show. Like McMillan came back and played drums for them. And TVH was kind of broken up at that point. So I was just like, man, I drum for you guys. I'm going to keep it going. And he contacted me like 2 months later. Like, you know what? I just want to start over something fresh. Yeah. And we thought about getting maybe a keyboardist or something. So it wasn't a traditional drum, bass, guitar line.
Right.
And we eventually was like, man, it's just too easy with the two of us.
And that became fairly popular, obviously, because of the White Stripes.
Right.
In that era of the late 90s or early 2000s. And somewhere in there, that kind of started to become a thing.
Yeah.
And it was very common.
Well, it's funny because, I mean, as a bassist, I don't usually like two-piece bands because right. that's almost always what's missing.
I think very few can pull it off.
Yeah.
It's a sound thing.
Yeah.
And it sounds like something's missing.
It's got to be the right
style. There's a band
style.
Out today called Black Gold that they were a three-piece with a bass player. They lost their bass player and decided to go on without him. And the Vincent, the guitar player, he just runs his guitar through two amps.
That's what JD does.
Yeah, same concept. Yeah. So I think, again, few can do it. And if you can do it, you do it well, then you seem to have a thing, and it seems to be good.
Yeah, we recorded like live to tape, which of all the records I've been on over the years, like I've never recorded live to tape before. Mm. And that was like, fuck, I don't know if I ever want to do that again. You know, it's like you get all the way to the end of a song and it's like, well, I'm really unhappy with this one thing I did. Time for yep. us to both start all the way over.
Yep. Yep.
I wanted to kill myself by the end of that. But we did get a couple songs in one take, which is, you know, like a point of pride, but But we had a couple offers, you know, like somebody'd see us play, like, you guys want a bassist or whatever? And we're like,
I think I was one of
Were you? Okay. I didn't know that. I guess you talked to JD, but we're both just kind of like, it'd be, I'm sure it would add a lot, but it's like right now, he sends me a text that's like, hey, can you do this? Yep. All right. It's over.
It works. And I've seen you guys a few times. I think it's great.
Well, I appreciate it. It made me play drums in a totally different way. Because like when I was drumming in TVH, we had so much going on with like bass effects, guitar effects, keyboards, all this. I felt like I played everything real tight, like a lot of closed hi-hats. Mm. And you know, we did a lot of like odd meter time. So everything, it had like a, all my drum beats, like I played the exact same thing every single show. Mm. Like I actually wrote parts and whatever. But with this with JD, the hi-hats open 90% of the time because you got to fill that space up a little bit, you know, more banging on shit.
It's like you can play drums, but you're also kind of a percussionist at the same time.
Yeah, basically.
And that adds just that small element to give it something.
Yeah.
So
trying to fill up more of that space with tom
hits
and stuff.
The two tones and the effects and the vocals end up becoming very much an instrument, not just
super
lead
important.
Vocals. It's like an instrument. It's part of the song. It's part of the band.
Yeah.
And so when your drumming turns into more than just keeping a solid beat, you do add those elements of like percussive type bells and rim shots and all that weird tacky stuff or whatever you want
to
call it.
What's funny, to go back to your like influences question, like I mean, honestly, I think one of the biggest influences, and this is not like just like a cop out, you know, kiss and ass kind of thing, but like like it's the people I've played with and the bands I've played, because it's been so many different genres, like I'll learn something new from each band and bring that in. And it's like, you know, I played with this guy, he showed me this one trick, and now I reuse that trick over and over. So then, yeah, so playing with JD with this band, it's kind of made me adopt a new way of approaching drums.
Right.
And
well, a good musician that you get involved with usually makes you step up your game.
Totally.
Because you'll notice from like rehearsal practices being taped or you know, listening back to things, you can always listen to yourself and go, whoa, I need to like amp it up a bit because this guy's really good, you know.
Yeah, you know, and that's the funny thing with the two piece where it's like it's just the two of you, so you're like,
it really stands out.
It took us a couple songs to figure out like, what are we even doing?
Yeah.
And I think like, because he lives in Nashville, so we haven't practiced in a while because we've just been playing a lot of shows. But when we were starting out, it was like he'd come up here every 2 weeks and I'd go down there. And I've never really told him this, so surprise, JD. But last year when we were getting it going over the summer, when I was going down there like every 2 weeks, like there were parts of me that was like, what am I doing? You know, like we haven't really figured out what we're doing yet with our sound. Like, do I even like this? Like, I love JD and I love playing with him, but like, do I really like what we're doing? It's taken a lot of my time.
Yeah.
And it took until we kind of really, we didn't really even talk about it. We just, you know, you got to get a few songs under your belt before they start turning into whatever they're going to turn into. And then it was like, I love it. But there was those few early songs where it was like a little, I don't know, straight ahead.
Just unsure.
Yeah, we have one that's almost just like a straight punk song where I'm just like, that's my least favorite song we have. Because, I mean, I love that stuff, but for us it was like, that's a very big indicator of our early sound.
Yeah, like, you know, it's missing something.
Yeah, we hadn't evolved. Because, I mean, now it's, you know, I'd get to use other beats other than just like straight punk beats or whatever. Right. You know, I'll try to do some stuff to spruce it up because we don't really delve in the odd meter stuff that I like to do.
Right. It's very straightforward.
Yeah. So it's like, let me try to come up with a new beat then that's a little different. And, but yeah, so I love it.
The thing that does kind of counterbalance what you do with Dos Cobros is Bass Invaders.
Oh, yeah.
Very interesting.
Appreciate that.
I first heard you guys at a show, I'd heard the name. And I knew you were involved, and then I went to see somebody, and you guys were playing as well at Tidballs. And I walked in, and I mean, it's such an enormous sound because it's three basses.
Right.
And when it's in a proper PA at a proper venue, it just shakes every bone in your body if you stand in the right place in the room, you know? And so what a cool concept. Three bass players, no lead vocals. The bass guitars are kind of the rhythm, lead, and vocals of it. It's like it's got all the right elements of what composed music consists of in a way.
Yeah, I'll agree with that.
With a solid drummer.
Yeah.
So I sat there and I watched you guys, and I'm not a big fan of instrumental stuff. We had talked at one point because your drummer had left or was in the process of leaving.
Well, we're on our third drummer.
I know. And I talked to you at one point.
Yeah.
I was kind of interested in playing drums, which I'd kind of put drums down because I wanted to play bass. And but as a drummer, I had an enormous amount of respect for what you all were doing and for you in general as a friend. And I was like, you know, if I was to play drums and dedicate to something, I could probably do that, even though I'm not a huge fan of instrumentals or anything overly complicated. Like, you could drop things like Rush and Genesis and things of that nature. But just, I thought it was original. It's very much local. It's very much different. And it's active.
Yeah.
You guys are very active and you play out quite a bit and you have awesome. I mean, the logo's cool as shit. You brought me the CD today, which I've heard stuff online, but I didn't have like the physical copy.
One of my favorite things I've ever been a part of.
But what you guys do as far as not only the band and what it consists of, but just the merch and everything to go with it.
Yeah.
Like, it's spot on, just everything a band would ever want.
Man, I really appreciate that.
But I mean it, you know, and I think to just delve on this a little bit, you said you do have a third drummer.
Yeah.
I was skeptical. We talked, but I never even followed up with like an audition. So,
well,
I think in a way it was probably better because I may have not been the right choice.
We came real close to splitting up.
Yeah. And you told me that.
Yeah. It was like, I mean, so we started. I mean, if you want to go back to the origins of Bass Invaders.
Who's in Bass Invaders?
Matt Bittner, who was the bassist in Technology Versus Horse.
Okay.
So Matt is, it's funny because I always talk about how long I've played with Nick Rouse, like 20-something years, but I've played with Matt for like 13 or 14 years now from TVH. And so Matt is his bass playing is unlike anybody else around. So I can't play like him, but he's got a unique approach. And then Will Cronenberger is the other bassist. He was in like Man O' Man and the Fairweather Kings, and he's about as rock solid as a bassist as you'll find. And the original drummer was Rory Willis.
Right.
And then we had Ben Mosley for a little while, and now we've landed Matt DeVore, which is like God level.
Matt just recently was.
Yeah. I mean, he's pretty much what kept us from breaking up, because when we lost Ben, it was just a whole thing of like, we've been a band for 3 years and we're about to look for our third drummer. It's going to look like there's a problem, you know? I mean, Rory, he moved to Nashville, and then he moved to Colorado, and that's why he quit.
Okay.
And then Ben hadn't been in a band in a while. And so when he started playing with us, it worked out great for a while, but I think he was just, he does a lot of work from home, and he does other musical stuff. And I think it was just kind of, he's got a wife, and I think maybe not being in a band for a while and then kind of jumping into it maybe got a little bit much.
Right.
Because he told us, like, I can keep playing shows with you guys, but I can't keep practicing every week. And we were like, man, we don't want to, like, string him along. Like, we appreciate that you were offering to do that.
Right.
So we did try out. Corey Link came and tried out, and it just...
Oh, yeah.
He...
I think I actually recommended Corey to look into it.
Yeah. Corey's a great guy, and he's a great drummer.
There was a weird time of you guys and Black Bloods at the same time looking for drummers.
Oh, yeah, because me and Blake were just like, he's mine. Let me have him.
I went to audition for Black Bloods, and I think Corey went to audition with you guys.
Yeah.
Because I also recommended he look into Black Bloods, too.
Right.
I was like, don't hire me just because I walk in and I'm the only drummer. Like, give it some chances and look for other people. But again, I'm still in this weird boat where I love drumming, but I don't really want to go back to doing it full time unless it's the perfect thing. Like, it has to really blow me away to like devote to it right now, and I hate to say that.
No,
and that's no offense to anybody out there.
I totally feel you.
I really want to be in like a full-blown happy place if I'm gonna keep playing drums.
Right. Yeah, no, I totally get it.
Matt's the perfect choice though, because he is the epitome of what a true drummer is. He's not only an amazing drum set player, he's as a percussionist, and a percussionist drummer belongs in a band like this.
Yeah,
he's a great fit for Fatbox, and he's a great fit for Bass Invaders because of his technique and his approach. So you definitely got the right guy.
Yeah,
to get in there, and has things been going well? This is fairly fresh.
Yeah, this is pretty new.
This interview being taped right now.
Yeah, we did our last show with Ben in June, and we tried out Corey in July, and Corey actually backed out. He was like, I don't think it's a fit, you know.
Okay.
And so he only, you know, jammed with us once, and he did message us back about maybe coming out a second time, like a month or so later. But it kind of really just grinded to a halt.
Mm-hmm.
We tried practicing without a drummer just to stay fresh, and it's like, man, some of this shit's so weird, like the timings, and it'll get into those real quiet
without
spots.
Without that foundation.
Yeah.
Like, the drummer is basically your canvas.
Yeah.
And you guys are three painters.
Sort of, yeah. I like that.
That's the way I've always looked at it.
I like that. And it was weird, so we kind of just, like, we looked into maybe, could we get a drum machine? Would that be weird? You know, or something like that. We even talked to Rory, like, you know, would you come back?
That.
Yeah, and we kind of just were like...
They don't give you any lip.
Yeah.
They show up on time.
Yeah. But we actually had a meeting. We were just like, you know, what are we doing? Like, it kind of got exhausting. We kept asking people, or people would ask us, and just things just weren't lining up.
Right.
And Matt chimed in, like, and we knew he was busy, and he was like, I can only practice this time, which, you know, I work an early schedule, so it wouldn't work for me. And then he was like, what if I learn your album on my own, and then we get together... before a gig or something, and I'm like, God, that's so fucking risky, you know, because you've booked the show. What if it doesn't work?
But
I'm thinking it's
it.
Matt DeVore, if there's anybody that can do it. So he got together with Bittner once, and then me and Will got together with him, and then finally we've all gotten together, I think, three times.
Okay.
And yeah, he fucking learned the whole album, like all the time changes, all the weird shit. I mean, he's putting his own approach on it,
right?
Which Ben obviously put his own approach, because Rory was the one who's on the album. So Ben played with us after the album came out, but, you know, immediately it was a different approach to what you would hear.
Well, you stick to the foundation of the song, but
the arrangements
you still
are the same.
Be yourself as far as like little fills and things of that nature.
Any band I've ever been in, which I haven't had to replace too many people or add people in, but it's always been like, just make it your own. Like, the structure will stay the same, but like, you don't have to play exactly that. Do whatever you want. And Matt's got some incredible ideas, and just how like all four limbs doing, like we got a part in 11, and he's just like got this like every third beat, you know, bell of the ride, like Danny Carey or something. It's like, I didn't even know that was possible, but he's doing it. So we had a show book next month, and then something came up with this kid's birthday, so we had to back off of it. But we'll get something in probably February or something like that.
Great.
Man, it
so
is
so 2019
fucking...
is looking good for Bass Invaders.
Yeah, we had five songs we wrote with Ben that we never recorded.
Okay.
So we're going to try to get Matt up on those, up to speed, as soon as we feel really solid about the album material that we already have. But yeah, it's, I mean, we were like, dude, you saved the band. And for me personally, like, this was like a dream band as a bass player first. And Bittner and I tried to get this band together as far back as like 2008 or 9.
Oh, wow.
We met with Nick Rouse, came out once, and he was just kind of busy, like, I can't do multiple bands. And then you know Ken Walker.
Mm-hmm.
Ken played with us once, and we threw a bunch of shit at him like in 5, and he was just like, that's not really my thing. And so
it
then
it is hard, man. I think that
it
might
takes
have what scared
to
me away from being your, like, even attempting to be an auditioning drummer. I was like, I don't know if I can
play
this.
Well, funny enough, when we first got it together, you know, Rory and Will were both a little bit like, I don't know. We'll,
yeah.
You know, we'll
I think
we'll
you have
humor
to sleep
you.
On it sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, it really can come to you in a different, relaxed state of mind. Like, you can get a better grip on it mentally.
Yeah.
It's kind of like some people can get on a bike and they can't ride it. They just physically can't ride it. But if they lay down at night and think about it, they can hop on it the next day and ride it like they've been riding it for years.
That's kind of exactly what happened.
It's that same kind of approach, you know?
Yeah, because they were, when they both came out, you could tell they were almost like humoring us, like as friends, like, yeah, we'll do this weird little thing, see what happens. And the first song we wrote was Doom Patrol, and it rocks. And, you know, it was like a good first song, like, shit, that was, you know, it worked out. And but it's all kind of like got that six, like, da-da-da-da-da-da-da kind of groove.
Right.
And then the second song Will brings in, and it's kind of got, he said it was very Death From Above is what he was going for.
Mm-hmm.
But then we get this middle section, and Matt brings in a part in 7. And Rory and Will had kind of specifically said, like, I don't know about the odd time stuff. You know, maybe we won't do that. And Matt, of course, just brings it in. And they caught it. And then so the next song, we do a couple other things. And the next thing you know, it's like it just, you know, they don't come from that background the way Matt and I do. But they just, they picked it up.
They
and
found.
And Will would start bringing in, like, some really weird shit. And I mean, next thing you know, like, here's a saw in huge chunks and like 11, you know, and stuff like that. And well, it's funny.
From the standpoint of being in the audience for one of these shows, I think a lot of people may walk in expecting it to be kind of like this experimental jam band type of thing.
Or like where really heavy.
The drums are just going and everybody's on acid and just starts going crazy. These songs actually have a beginning, middle, and end. Like,
oh,
they're
yeah.
structured. They're written,
very structured.
You stick to a plan. You don't just stick, you know, get the intro and the end right and let it just kind of,
right.
It's not like the Grateful Dead, you know.
Well, it's funny you say that, because the first, like, maybe three or four shows we did, we only had like four or five songs, mm-hmm. and we were always the opener, and we would take like a designated 5 minutes and jam,
right?
Which was like, I'm really not crazy about doing that, and I'm not comfortable with it either, but we had some good moments in those jams. It was just kind of funny, like, we're really just fucking jamming up here, like, what are we doing? But yeah, it's very rigidly structured.
Early days, that kind of helps, you know, evolve, and
yeah,
the evolution of what the band becomes sometimes just comes from jamming and getting to know each other.
Yeah.
And then over time you can just kind of walk in and kind of just know.
Well, I feel like a lot of jamming usually like turns into like here's your guy wanking off over here on guitar,
right.
or whatever.
There's always the show off.
Yeah, and I've never been a fan of that. No. Like, I don't really, one out of 100 songs you'll hear me play a guitar solo or something. Yeah. And it's not even really a solo. It's one of those John Frusciante, like, I guess that's a solo.
But
you know what I mean? Like,
I guess.
Yeah, I mean, a 12-year-old can play it. It's just a lead melody or whatever.
Right.
But
as three bass players in a band, do you all have a role that you're assigned to?
No.
Like, does everyone kind of get to hold the bottom groove and do lead type things and melodies? And
yeah, and it's...
You
I
just
would
kind
say
of pick and choose. What
it's usually
parts
who brings a part in,
right?
Because it just that tends to be the bass part.
Right.
Like, if I bring
you,
this in,
you
they're
do
gonna,
this
they're
part,
gonna write
and then I'm
going
to come in with this part, and you go back to the root note.
Yeah.
Note.
Well, everybody kind of writes their own part, like
right.
for themselves. Like, I'll bring something in, and to me, this isn't necessarily the foundation. But then when Matt and Will start playing on top of it, it's like, I guess it is the foundation
right.
now because
it's a little more clear.
Yeah. I'd say most of the time Will is kind of the traditional bass player of the band.
Okay.
And then I would view Matt as more of the lead, and then I'll do, because from coming from like the Chest Rockwell, like twinkly delay guitar parts and shit, like I do a lot of that stuff.
Right.
Or I'll play chords because Will plays with a pick, Matt plays with his fingers. I'll
okay.
do both, or
and
I'll slap
big,
something. So it gives it three different
that
tones.
Definitely gives it a big dimension too.
Yeah, and I mean, if you look at my amp settings, the low end is completely rolled back.
Oh,
it's
wow.
somebody at a show made a treble invaders joke once, and we were just like, I mean, we could just blow your ass out of here with
that
a bunch
would be
of mud.
The name
that's
you
what
use
you're expecting,
when you
I guess.
Play a show where it's like a secret show,
right? Yeah, the treble
the
invaders
treble
coming
invaders.
For you. All guitars now.
Oh, that's just the bass invaders.
We're just playing guitars with octave pedals on. But I mean, that's what we do. We use a lot of octave pedals, a lot
right.
of effects and stuff like that. And
it's very effect driven. It's
well, you
very
listen to the album
groove.
And it's not like there's like one guy in the middle, one on each side.
Right.
You'll hear a low end part and that's maybe Will, but then the next part that comes up, I'm doing the low end part.
Right.
And you might would think it's one guy that always does it.
Hmm.
That's kind of the cool thing. If you listen to it, like, you don't know who's doing what part.
And that's great.
It is cool.
That means it's a collective.
Yeah, there's
unit
no
thing,
assigned
yeah.
role, nothing like that.
That's cool. So Dos Cobros
uh-huh.
and Bass Invaders are modern, current things that you're very much involved in.
Yes.
Most people, I would say, are familiar with you, your name, and your face involved with Chest Rockwell and Peter the Freshman,
yeah.
which are the same band. For
essentially,
the most part.
Yes, yeah.
I think, is it Jamie?
Jessica.
Jessica. I'm so sorry.
No, you're good.
I was really close, though.
Yeah, well, she just joined us.
She's only with the Peter the Freshman thing, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So explain the difference. Like, when did Chest Rockwell get started? Who's in Chest Rockwell? And how did it evolve into Peter the Freshman?
Okay. Chest Rockwell spun out of the Pimp Slap mm-hmm. thing. I wrote some songs. This would have been, like, 2003.
Right.
And then I got Nick and Stewie on board. And we picked up Seth. After our first album recorded, we put that out in 2005. He joined the band before the album came out, but he wasn't on it.
Okay.
So Seth's been with us since 2005, and when he came in, because when it was a three-piece, it was mostly like all acoustic electric, and it was kind of still like maybe a little aggressive at times, mm-hmm. but as aggressive as that can be. And we started getting into like some odd meter stuff, but then when Seth came in, he added a lot of texture.
Mm-hmm.
So then the band became, it had a little bit of like a modern-ish Pink Floyd-y kind of.
Okay.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know that anybody else would say that, but to me it was.
Just approach-wise, like, yeah, you guys are very.
Here's an 8-minute song with, yeah, all this shit. And then I switched over to electric, and it started getting a little heavier, and it's kind of more, it has more like a post-rock meets prog rock with some metal-y kind of stuff in it now. And we were just, you know, you're just pumping out an album like every couple of years. Mm-hmm. And we, my cousin David started playing with us in 2011. So we did, we had an album that we split in two. We did like first half of it as an EP. The guy that we record with had a kid, so he couldn't get together for a second session. So we just released half of it. David actually was on the second half, which is kind of weird.
Hmm.
But we did that, and then we ended up, eventually, when they kind of went out of sold out, we pressed them together as the full length they were supposed to be. But anyway, so David joined. He was on that, and he was on that 7-inch. But we kind of just, we were writing songs. You just kind of like banging your head against the wall. Like, God, we've put out like 5 albums or whatever. Like, why are we so stressed about this, like putting out another album, like who gives a shit, you know? And so we just decided as a fun thing, like, let's do this 90s cover deal that we'd always kind of joked about. And we started learning a bunch of 90s songs, and initially it wasn't going to be what it is. It was like, we'll do like a lot of one-hit wonders people kind of forgot about,
just an opportunity to get gigs you normally wouldn't, and that pay,
get some money.
All the original bands usually don't make money at all,
or you're splitting it with the other bands,
especially around this area. Don't seem to have any problem.
No, not
you
at
can
all.
Ask for $100. You can ask for $500.
We played a birthday party and just asked for $500. Yeah. And I mean, from what I understand, it's actually even kind of low. I mean, if you're going to bring your PA and all that.
Yeah, cover band payment in 2018 is the same as it was in 1988.
Well, I mean, you know, you're going to look Tyro and Dunn. You're going to get $2,000 or so. I'm basing it off nothing.
Yeah,
but
if you get friendly with the law enforcement and the law firms and big corporations, you can usually make some pretty good money.
Yeah. But so we just.
And what time? What year did it start to evolve? Kind of doing both.
I feel like it was around the end of 2013, maybe, is when we started doing this. We were still doing Chest Rockwell.
About 5 years.
Yeah, about 5 years. We played our first show, I think, in spring of 2014 as Peter the Freshman. And
I remember seeing the name on
flyers.
From
Rules of Attraction.
Yeah, and your flyers were always fantastic.
Appreciate it. Like, I've gotten guys, real lazy
again,
on the flyers.
It's like
now.
Every time I see something that you're involved in, or I see something and then I find out you're in it, and I'm like, oh, that explains why it's so well done.
Thank you.
I mean, everything you've been involved with seems like, I don't know if it's necessarily you in general, but you and the people you're involved in have a great knack for promotion and design and the way that things are handled. So I tip my hat to you.
Well,
because
I appreciate
a lot of people
it.
Don't give a damn about that.
Well,
stuff.
I definitely will not take full credit for that. I mean, like, JD does a lot of this stuff with Cobros, and the Bass Invaders designs Will Cronenberger did, like with the logo
and the
name
and everything.
Yeah, and then we commissioned an artist to do some of that.
Right.
And in TVH,
just the vision. Like, to as a group, obviously you all sit around and go, yes, you know,
and some of it kind of just comes together. But with Chest Rockwell, it's been nice because Matt Simone, I had him do artwork. I did a little Chest
poster that's on my wall over here.
Yeah, he did a. I did an EP by myself in like 2003 or 4 before the band came out.
Okay.
And I got him to do the art for that. And then it went from there. And he's always done the Chest Rockwell art. So that kind of gave us like a uniform look that you knew you were going to get on the next album. Like you knew exactly who that is.
Yeah, it's good.
But
great guy,
like,
too. Just
yeah,
super
one of my best
nice
friends
guy.
In the world. But we kind of got lucky with that. But then as far as the flyers and stuff go, man, it's like I don't know how to half-ass something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a blessing and a curse, I guess, because it's like you obsess over shit and you stress out.
Right.
But at the same time,
you
like,
care.
You don't
want to just throw it down. Online with no, you know, you want hard copies. You want people to physically hold stuff.
And yeah.
You treat your music as art.
Definitely.
And so it therefore means something to you.
Yeah.
So
you
care, and that's why you stress about it.
Well, I had an interesting conversation with old Chuck Falcon or Aaron Clark, whatever you want to know him by, actually like last week.
Daddy Sister.
Yeah. And he was talking about, you know, Daddy Sisters. He's like, I've only got, I don't remember, X amount of love songs for this. Normally I fall back on that.
Right.
And, you know, I'm trying to limit that. And I was like, man, I haven't written a love song in 15 years. Like, because that's what people tend to go to. And I mean, I became one of these, you know, real pretentious guys, you know, my shit's so important or whatever. It means something, whatever, you know. But so I started trying to, like, take, like, I don't write a song because I think anybody's going to like it. I write it because I like it.
Right.
And hence, I have no success at all. But, you know, for me, I love it. And so, well, you know, we wrote a Chest Rockwell album about the Trojan War because it's like, oh, that'll be interesting. I mean, I wrote one album that was like all my political social views, you know, right. Where that's so normal, though. Then the album we've been working on for several years now is it's like this big sci-fi story I came up with. You know, I didn't have anything to do with the lyrical content of like that I didn't sing. Mm-hmm. But either way, it's just like trying to take this. That's not unique in any way. I mean, band's been doing that shit forever, but you know, just not a mainstream approach to stuff.
No.
And so,
but it's your approach,
right? And so,
I mean, you have to have personal satisfaction, I think, first, and then if you have one person come up to you and go, this meant so much to me, I love this record, yeah, I love this song, then you've done what you set out to do. You're happy with it, and you've made someone else happy.
Yeah.
And therefore, you don't care if you have thousands of fans or make a lot
you're
of money, which
right.
always is great to think about. And
right.
I think most musicians, whether they want to admit it or not, would love to be successful. But
yeah,
you can also delicately try to handle it to where it's not blown out of proportion and turn into something you don't want it to be.
Yeah.
But that's just my two cents on that thing.
No, I agree with that.
Personal satisfaction hopefully rolls into actual people being fans and letting you know that you're good at what you do and they have meaning in it.
Yeah, I agree. Like when we did Commander, we pushed it a little. Like that was real close to like taking a step up. Like we actually talked with a couple labels,
right.
Like we sent some stuff to them, they responded
when
or whatever.
It still existed,
right, when it still like meant something. TVH, I always thought there was like a weird factor there, and we had some poppy songs, mm-hmm. and once we kind of stopped trying to intentionally run people out of the room, like we got a fan base, and I always thought like if the right person saw this, but we just can't get on
right.
those gigs, you know. And so there were a few times and it was like, yeah, I think this, if we could maybe steer it in this direction, but keep it what we want.
Right.
But with Chest Rockwell, I've never been like a great singer. And Peter the Freshman has made me a better singer.
Okay.
And so now I look back on all the old albums just like, it's fucking terrible. But I'd re-record all of it if I could. But
that's, again,
it's progression,
part of,
I guess.
Yeah, it's part of the progression and the evolution of you as a musician personally.
Yeah, you're right.
You have surrounded yourself with some of the best people. And obviously, they're very good friends.
Well, I've almost never been in
talented.
A band with somebody that's not a friend. I've almost never just been like, hey, there's a guy that they're
right.
looking for or whatever, and I joined. It's always been like, these are my friends. Let's play together.
Right. Well, you do have a lot of friends. You have been part of the music scene for quite some time. What are some of the bands that you enjoy as of today or even in the past? Like, who are some of your favorites around
like
here?
Like local bands?
Yeah.
Man,
yeah,
actually,
locally, not just Bowling Green, but maybe like the Louisville, Lexington area, maybe Nashville.
That's a tough question. I feel like right now there's not as many. I feel like it's in a weird spot.
It is.
Yeah. Like I'll see bands playing and I don't know who they are,
yeah.
or I'm not seeing the crowds I used to see.
The next generation is
right.
starting to come up, and that's always an odd transition. And I've witnessed it over
yeah.
decades now. And it, you know, I was a part of it, but I was also part of the older generation watching the new generation come in. It's
yeah.
like, who is this band? They keep getting gigs and I can't get any gigs, but they're playing all the time.
Well, I'm kind of one of those like cliche guys where it's like, I haven't liked a new band in 15 years. You
right.
know, all the good bands don't exist anymore. You know, one of those assholes. But I mean, you know, growing up, like every other local band was an influence. So we played shows with Grand Monster,
oh, yeah.
and Porn Lord. I mean, you know, going
yeah.
way back to bands that, you know, the younger kids now aren't going to know who they even are. But, you know, there was definitely some of that middle ground in the mid 2000s when like the MySpace era, when
right.
we were all playing Spencer's and stuff like that.
Yep.
And of course, I'm drawing a blank right now, but I mean, like Lee Harvey, we used to do some shows with him. And,
right. We did. Well, Spencer's and Java House seemed to have
yeah.
a lot of good shows for
yeah.
us, and that was Tidballs opened in 2001.
I can't remember.
I was one of the first bands to play there, and that was cool.
Yeah,
but yeah, there was a cool time where there was Cafe Voltaire.
I never
you remember
went
any of that.
I do remember it, but I never went.
I'm a little bit older than you, but I know you should have been around at that point.
Yeah, my
that
brother
was like late 90s,
place.
early 2000.
Yeah, well, I wasn't. If it was like when I wasn't able to drive yet, and we were teenagers, is that weird thing. My brother, maybe that day wouldn't have taken me along because I was a younger brother.
And well, you mentioned Digglers, though.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, what, 97, 98? 98-ish.
Yeah, because my brother founded that with Jim Madison.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's right. I forgot about that. Jim was part of that.
Yeah.
I never played there, but I did attend, I think, a few shows. Reminiscing back on the club scene and stuff, I mean, it's not just bands, but club-wise, I mean, what's your take on the music scene then and now?
It's funny because being this age where, like, I went through bands releasing shit on cassette with basically no internet presence.
Right.
I mean, it was like their own website was a fucking Mindspring site or whatever, you know? And then you get into the MySpace days, and that's, to me, that was really when, as a local musician, things were at their peak in this area, because not everybody was still popping out of the woodwork,
right.
But more people were coming out, and there's an easier way to promote stuff. And I mean, it may sound like an old man thing, but like the internet wasn't really, I'm not going to say it's ruined it, because it definitely hasn't, but people were still going to shows, and still,
right.
We were still, I mean, we put out an album in 2009 and sold out on the release show. Like, fuck, now I can't even sell 10 over the course of the entire pressing because people are going to get on Bandcamp, which I love Bandcamp.
It's very much a blessing and a curse, I think, at the same time.
So it's weird to have gone from, like, that into, like, that peak area, and now we're totally in, like, the internet age where not as many people are going to go to shows.
You don't have to go to shows because it seems like a band has that one fan that goes to everything.
It takes all the video.
And they go live.
Yeah.
They'll go Facebook Live or Instagram Live. I don't even have to leave my couch, and I can watch Bass Invaders at Tidballs because somebody's there filming.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big thing right now.
Yeah.
A lot of club owners are a little rattled on that. And to me, I don't know. You can't shut it down.
Right.
But you don't want to put up a quality video camera service in your bar to film the bands live for your Facebook page, because then nobody's going to come. They're just going to tune in like it's watching MTV again or something.
Yeah, you know, and that's the funny thing. Like, when we did Commander, it was like 05 to 07, so we had great crowds through that time. I was like, for me personally, that was
a good era.
That was a perfect era. Yeah. And then, like, with Chest Rockwell, we had really big crowds when we were shitty. Like, when we were starting out, and it's like the worst era of the band had the biggest crowds, and then we started getting better, and the crowds died, and then they'll start to come back, and whatever. Like, we're super skeptical about how this show is going to go. We have in a couple weeks, because we've been playing these last few years, but not as often. And we haven't played Tidballs in probably two years.
Well, after this will air after
that
the
show. Okay,
so
well,
you had
hopefully,
a great show.
I hope so.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Everybody loved it.
But, you know, through Peter the Freshman, we almost never play bad shows, which is...
You've had some good shows.
We have.
I've attended a few, and I've noticed on the ones I've missed that you guys had a great turnout.
We had such a good turnout at our last gig that I got lost in a song because the crowd was singing along so much. As like, and it was one that Jessica was singing.
Okay.
I was like, I don't know where the fuck we are. Like, I literally have no clue what part we're in because I can't hear anything.
That's cool.
It was cool, but it's like, of course, you get that playing somebody else's shit.
Yeah.
You know, come see my band and don't
fucking care. That's unfortunately
the way it goes.
That's a big thing about Bowling Green is cover bands.
Yeah.
It's a good thing and it's a bad thing.
We make good money
doing
it. I
did it for a long time. I lost my identity.
Yeah.
And that's why I started doing my own, like, solo writing.
Well, you have to keep something on the side.
Yeah. But I totally, totally got lost. And I felt, I've apologized to people. Like, I would come up to people at Tidballs and be like, look, I'm really sorry. I got lost in the money. I was making money.
Right.
I was playing all the time. But I was so unhappy. And it took me a long time to even have the balls to admit that I felt like I was still involved in this music scene, but for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
And that's a terrible thing, but at least I'll admit it.
I mean, man, I'll be honest. I think about quitting music every single day, and I'm like, nobody would even care if I did. You know, like, who would fucking miss it? Nobody. But then I see my guitar sitting there, and I was like, I guess I'll pick that up.
You know, the only person that would miss it's you.
Yeah, that's how I feel.
I physically can't stop. I've tried, like, and it lasted 3 days. I can't.
I've never even
tried.
I just think about
it.
I just talk shit.
It's not about playing the instrument, writing songs. It's not about band practices. It's not about booking and making posters, which I love every aspect of it. people ask me all the time, don't you hate loading in? No, I love it because I'm here.
Yeah.
I can sit at home
right,
and watch TV while all my friends are out playing gigs, or I can hurt my back and right, load my gear into this venue and play and close my eyes and just have the time of my life.
Yeah. You know,
it's just one of those things where, you know, you're always going to have those moments, but, I mean, for me personally, it's been a roller coaster
yeah,
to be a part of this music scene, but I'm very glad I'm part of it. I'm very glad people like you are part of it.
Well, I appreciate it. I mean, I've had some bandmates before where, like, you know, we want to play some shows, so you book a gig somewhere in Louisville or Indiana or whatever, right, and then you get there and you're playing to the other bands.
Yeah.
And then they'll complain about it, and it's like, look, you tell me how to magically make a crowd appear in a place we've never been before, and I'll fucking do it. But one of these days, you're going to miss this.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at it now with some of those guys, and it's like, well, I'm still playing to six people occasionally. Who fucking yeah, cares? You're not playing anymore. Like you said, you have to appreciate it for what right, it is. Like, you love playing music or you don't.
Yeah.
And
well, I think getting audience and crowds takes work. And the biggest problem I've noticed personally is I'm only one member of a group. I can't do it. You know,
yeah,
like, I've always thought, why am I the one doing all the poster? I'm still old school. I hang up posters on bulletin boards. I go all over Bowling Green and, yeah, and hit anywhere that
you
I'll
do,
allow
man.
It.
Your enthusiasm is something like sorely missed
because I can't let it die. And I feel like I'm hoping that I'm somewhat of a beacon of hope for other people. Like, don't give up.
Yeah,
because it's just known the fact that we're a college town. I've never thought Western being in or not had anything to do with whether or not there was an audience at a show. It plays a part.
Yeah.
But that college does not determine whether or not a band can pack a venue, whether or not it's in or out. Because there's thousands of people in this town.
Yeah, I've had
that mixed
experiences
with that.
That
go to Nashville and Louisville to see a band, but they won't go pay $5 to see a band here.
That is
because
true.
Because I think they like the idea of leaving town, getting out of home, yeah, getting out of town for a bit, and going out and partying. Because if you're here, it's almost like the dreaded, I'm home.
Well, the thing I'll say is, like, some of the original bands that I do will be pretty consistent crowds for better or worse.
Right.
But with something like Peter the Freshman, we may play a show in early May and pack it, and then do one in, like, mid-June, and it's a bit slow,
right,
because that's kind of who that crowd is. It's the sort of casual
right,
comers, and then, you know, it gets into August and all of a sudden it's packed again,
right?
So yeah,
you do, I mean, I guess in your stance you see the difference between
yeah,
Western being in or out
yeah
of session.
But I don't think it's necessarily for every band, because right, you know, you're going to get like Morning Teleportation is going to play and they're going to pack it no matter what mm-hmm, happens, because people will come, you know, come up from Nashville or maybe
yeah,
even Louisville or something for that. You know, we don't really have that draw, but yeah, I mean, hell, these days, man, I'm just happy if anybody's there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so hit and miss. You drive so far away and you play for no one, and then you,
but you still love it.
Oh,
I
of
think
course.
You,
yeah.
You're not
I can't
gonna,
quit.
Yeah.
I talk about it. I mean, it's one of those things. Like, I tell everybody I hate music. Like, what do you love? I don't love anything. I hate it. But it's like that thing where you love it so much that you then fucking hate it, because yeah, it's like, it takes so much out of you. Like, you, I'm currently, not a whole lot of people know about it, but I'm currently actually doing a black metal album. I'm writing, recording the whole thing on my phone. And it's been like this.
Just you?
Just me.
Okay.
And it's been like this, I've got like six songs done, but it's been like an obsession I've had for like the
wow,
last like 6 weeks. And I don't know if I'm going to form a band or not. I don't really have time for another
black
band.
Black metal.
Yeah, I love black metal. But I lately was like, I just want to see if I can do it.
I saw a band recently that was a black metal band, musically speaking.
Yeah.
You know, and I've seen a few, but it was kind of like, I don't know.
I mean,
it's different for me.
Yeah.
But I grew up around the era of the death metal scene coming out of Florida,
yeah,
mid-80s and stuff, and I got to see that firsthand, and I never really cared for it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not a big fan of, like, fast double bass.
Oh,
I think there's
yeah,
a difference between thrash.
Oh, this album is like...
There's a difference
the
between
whole album,
thrash, skateboard,
right,
heavy metal type stuff, and super death metal, black metal, or whatever you call it. I see the difference.
Oh, there's totally
I can hang
difference.
With the thrash metal. I can't hang with the black death metal stuff.
So. Yeah, and there's a line, you know, between I had to like kind of research. And again, it kind of goes back to that, like every band I've played with, I kind of learned something new from. Right. Like Seth made me a much better guitar player, and you
Seth's
know,
he's an excellent guitar
yeah,
player.
Yeah, and I've learned so much from
he
him.
He gives
but
me a lot of shit, and he's really good with sarcasm. But I just. All I can do is praise him because
yeah.
he's a phenomenal musician.
Yeah, he's awesome. And it's just kind of that same thing of like people you play with or like styles. So, you know, I you play in Commander, I learned this type of metal. It's right. more like thrash and kind of old school stuff. But then when I was just, it was just on a whim, just like, fucking, I want to make a black metal album just to see if I can. And that's one of those things cool. that like you'll get like people in that genre will be like a one-man band. They'll never right. play gigs, but they'll just, you know, write and record solo. So it's like, oh, this is perfect.
It's a happy place.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, but you, it just, you want to do it.
Yeah. And I had to like kind of study it. Like, yeah. like really start listening to these bands in a different way. And, you know, you don't overcomplicate it. It is what it is. Don't write too many riffs and right. stuff like that. And it's kind of become a learning thing where now that we're doing Chest Rockwell again, it's like, I'm probably going to slide a couple black metal riffs in here, you know? I mean, I'm sure they won't turn out that way because Nick's not going to play that type of drums to it.
Right.
But as far as what I'm doing on guitar, it's going to come from that. But yeah, it's, I don't know, you get obsessed with shit and, you know, it's kind of just like looking for new challenges. I mean, like, Peter the Freshman made me a much better singer than I ever was mm-hmm. before. It just kind of like, I have to do something I wasn't doing before because you find yourself staying in that rut or you're boxing yourself right. in. And so, yeah, that's just kind of been like the next thing. And it's, we'll see how it goes. I mean, I don't have time for another band, but we'll see. I always squeeze
another
one out.
You always have time for yourself.
Like, I always squeeze one more out.
Well, Seth, I appreciate Seth. I'm talking about Seth, and now I'm thinking about Seth. I was going to ask you about the fact that you have been with Seth Wilson for a while.
Yeah.
I have recently been working with Seth on the side. He got involved with my project, mm-hmm. and now we're actually jamming looking at another project. Seth Wilson and Nick, y'all call him Stewie, right?
Yeah, Nick Stewart,
yeah.
the bassist.
Okay, and then Nick Rouse.
Yes.
That's the core members of...
That's Chest Rockwell.
That's Chest Rockwell.
Yeah, my cousin David was with us for 3 years.
Right.
And he was initially in Peter the... It's funny how that worked. He was in Peter the Freshman for like a year. And then he moved. And right after he moved, like his... We did his last show. And then our very next show was Jessica's first show. Like right. they never actually crossed each other at all.
Huh.
She came to the last Chest Rockwell show that David played.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of like this weird, like almost crossing each other thing. Like the girl I'm dating now, we met... through Peter the Freshman, basically.
That's cool.
And the first show her and her friends came to was Jessica's first show.
Okay.
So it's like they never saw this other, and it's the same shit, but David played keyboard, so we would do like Depeche Mode or some other stuff like that, which yeah. I, you know, we did some Cure songs. I really yeah. miss doing that stuff.
Without the keyboard.
I yeah.
I think I accidentally slipped Seth's name in there because I wanted to do one of these with Seth, and he said, no, do it with Josh.
He actually said that to me the other
Josh
day.
Josh has like got way more stories to tell than I do, so I'm sorry I called you Seth.
Oh, no worries, man. I mean, Seth is, you know, Seth's one of my best friends in the whole world. Like, we yep. went to Egypt together this year. And
yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, he's a fantastic
really enjoyed
person.
That trip.
He did. I'm really glad he got to go with me. And but yeah. That's the core of the band, so it's kind of one of those weird things where it's like then we do Peter the Freshman and then we go back to doing Chest Rockwell mm-hmm. and it's weird because it's like, Jessica, just don't come out this week, you know, because we're going to do this stuff instead. And it's kind of a weird balance. I wish we could do two practices a week, or yeah. you could do one or the other, because like when I was in Commander we would do like two or three a week.
Well, I mean, you're in like four bands, so
true, but like Bad Dudes, you know, being a Chili Peppers band, we practice out of necessity.
You listen to the records.
Exactly. And then you get together and tighten it up.
Yeah.
Cobros, we've practiced probably twice in 6 months because right. we just keep doing shows. I mean,
but
we're
again,
not writing
like,
much.
You guys are just good at being able to read each other. You just kind of know.
Yeah, it sucks for writing is what it's for. It sucks. Yeah.
But I would think that it's a solid relationship as a band because you just know each other so well.
Yeah.
You don't even have to think about stuff.
Yeah.
You can just kind of wing it and do it and know it's going to turn out pretty good.
That's the funny thing with Chest Rockwell that we have is since it's like, I mean, Stewie and Nick and I go back to high school together.
Right.
Yeah. You know, there's like over 20 years there. So there'll be like a weird mistake at a show. You're kind of looking around. And it's like, oh, it just magically worked itself back out. You know, like no big deal. And not everybody or every band can do that shit. I mean, I could give you a whole fucking podcast about the chaos that was technology versus horse. Well,
that's what part two will be.
Yeah, people walking off stage and
Josh Hines part two.
People, yeah.
That the Electric
band,
Boogaloo.
That band should have had a behind the music more than anybody.
That band had a phenomenal name. And we were talking about this before we started rolling today about band names and how cool band name can just kind of judge the book by the cover kind of thing.
Right.
And I think that band had one of the best names in rock and roll.
I played no role in that. You know, I was the second drummer of that band. So I played no role in it, but I agree.
But you were still a part of it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was on 5 or 6 albums with that band.
Yeah. Yeah. So where can anyone out there find anything about Josh Hines, and what direction do you want to start pointing them to to find your music?
All right. Well, I guess we'll go strictly Bandcamp because I don't remember the exact Facebook, but there is a Chest Rockwell Facebook. There's a Peter the Freshman, Bass Invaders.
So good chance if anyone Googled these names, they would probably
if you Google them for like Bowling Green or whatever. I mean, I even made like a Pimp Slap and a Commander Facebook page. Yeah,
that's good.
I feel like I was in Lust for Diva with Mike Natcher and Fenner, and since that's more like Mike Natcher's thing.
Wow.
Yeah, you know that?
I
was on one of the albums.
But it's like I didn't know where this conversation would go. At the beginning, I just wrote down the
give
core
me a microphone, I'll
elements.
Ramble.
I know what you're in now. I know a few of the things. I knew there was a lot of stuff you'd done over the years because I think you and I have a lot in common about being in bands that lasted for like 6 months.
Yeah.
But they actually had cool names and they actually did something.
Yeah, you actually
so
played,
it's
played
still
a little bit.
A part of the music scene.
Shit, man. I was in a band called the Mexican Hat Dance that... came after Commander, and that was with the guys from Martha Divine. You know, that band was like 8 months, but yeah, we recorded and shit. Let me just drop another one on you, but all these bands have Facebooks. I mean, I want to say it's either Commander Band or Commander Thrash is the Bandcamp, and I've got everything up on there.
Okay,
the EP, the album, some shit we didn't even release.
That's great. Chest keeps it alive.
Yeah, you know? It does. And I really thought that was important after Jeremy died.
Definitely.
Yeah, and because that was actually one of the last conversations Jeremy and I had. We had talked about doing a Pimp Slap reunion at one point, and he was very against it because he wrote the lyrics for a lot of that shit because he was the singer, and it was high school stuff or early 20s. And then you look at it as like a 30-something-year-old, and you're just like, ugh. But I'm just like, man, it is what it is. It's a little time capsule.
A grown-up adult and do dick jokes. And...
Right, but at the same time, it's like we wouldn't reunite the band. It was just like to do a show
just a
or
one-off.
Something.
Yeah, right.
And I put that stuff up on Bandcamp, and when he found out, he was kind of upset about it.
Oh, wow.
Because I guess it's his voice and stuff like that. And
well, of course, it's given him acknowledgement of doing it, so I guess he was probably afraid of any kind of backlash from it.
I think Jeremy just wanted to kind of leave some of the past in the past with that stuff, and that's kind of like probably the biggest regret I have in my entire life is... You know, we were like best friends, but we I wouldn't say we had a falling out, but we certainly just because our musical ideas were a little different, we kind of just like, well, for the sake of being friends, we probably shouldn't play music together anymore. And then you find yourself busy playing music with other people, so you find yourself not hanging out anymore because, you know, you don't have that just easy way of doing it. But we had talked about a year before he died about doing something, and I was hesitant because it was like, oh, I don't know, man, we're going to clash again, and I've already got all these other shit going on, and... And so we didn't, and you just kind of always assumed one day we'll get to that point and it's taken from you, you know? Yeah. But for me, I mean, I don't have access to any of the stuff he did with like Billy Swayze or Carmadons or any of that.
Right.
So wherever that stuff is, I don't know. But as far as what I was with him with like Pimp Slap and Commander, all that stuff's out there. It's on Bandcamp and Facebook both. I mean, and that's a lot of that stuff so old now that not a lot of the people these days even probably heard of it. But... For some people, they're still around. I mean, you go back, there it is, kind of relive it, see what that was all about if you want to. I mean, there's even some videos of that shit up, but...
Well, you're very much part of this music scene, and whether you ever feel it or sit back and acknowledge it...
Well, I appreciate it.
You need to know from not only me as a friend and a fan of what you do, but I'm sure many out there listening to this would agree with me and saying thank you. You have helped create this music scene and keep it alive, and you're very much a part of it, and that's why you needed to be on this Sound Atlas, because
that means
you are very much an important part of the Bowling Green music scene.
Man, I really appreciate that. You know, it's there's been a couple of times recently, actually, where like Blake from Black Bloods, mm-hmm. I knew Blake when he was in high school, when I would have been like 22 or something.
Right.
He's kind of the one that pushed us to get Chest Rockwell going again. He wanted us to do a show with Black Bloods before they, I don't know if they're still together looking for replacement pieces or what, but that's kind of what started it. But he was just like, man, you know, you were such an influence on me and all this stuff. And I'm just standing there like, man, that's just, you don't hear that a lot.
Right.
You know, it meant a fucking lot. You know, so Blake, thank you for telling me that. You know, those times when you're just like, why am I still doing this?
That's
and then like
why.
A week later, somebody tells you
when
that. It's like,
happens,
yeah,
that's why.
Yeah. And so to hear that stuff, hear it from you, man, that's like super special to
me.
Like,
true.
I really appreciate
and
that.
I think when Russell started this podcast, that this is the meaning behind it, to capture these stories, to keep them in some sort of time capsule. Our scene is deep and rich with history.
Yeah.
And I think Russell and Tommy both have done a phenomenal job of sitting down with a lot of key people. And I'm hoping that I'm able to keep that going because this is one of the first episodes I've done. And I'm really hoping that I'm helping keep that alive. So,
well, I see we're dragging you out there.
You deserve to be
well,
here
thank
today,
you.
And you deserve everything that you ever get as far as accolades and
man,
any
I really
kind
appreciate
of
that.
Applause. So,
well, thank you.
Keep doing what you're doing, and thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Dean.
And we will talk to you soon, and hopefully catch you at a Chester Rockwell show.
Yeah, I'll plug it. Chester Rockwell, Bass Invaders. Shit, I'm only drawing a blank on my own shit. Peter the Freshman.
Dose Cobras.
Bad Dudes. Dose Cobras. And maybe I'll get to something else here. We'll see.
If you hear any of
those
names,
are the big ones that
Josh Hines is involved. And
run
go
the other way.
See him on stage and enjoy the hell out of it.
Oh, thank you. I'll do my best.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Dean.